Welcome to the NHL Wraparound Podcast, featuring Neil Smith, President, General Manager of the 1994 Stanley Cup champion New York Rangers, and longtime ESPN NHL veteran Vic Morin. Together, they share no-nonsense opinions on news and issues around the National Hockey League. Whether you're a casual or diehard fan, each episode of NHL Wraparound will leave you more informed. Now, here's your hosts, Neil and Vic.
And welcome to NHL Wraparound, folks. Vic Morin along with Neil Smith. And before we start our show today, just a reminder that on our website, you can download and listen to the first of our series, 1990 Forever, the 30th anniversary commemoration of the 1994 New York Rangers Stanley Cup run. The first episode, The Road Begins, is now airing with Glenn Healy and John Davidson. And coming up on our show today, our special guest, longtime bench boss and now retired head coach from the Winnipeg Jets, Rick Bowness. But first, a word from Migray.
From Howe to Hughes, from Béliveau to Bedard, we're your source for game-worn jerseys. Go to Migray.com, M-E-I-G-R-A-Y.com, to start your collection today. Get real. Get it from Migray.
Well, Vic, what you got up your craw today?
And there's plenty of crawing going on. So, the Stanley Cup final will be opening on the 8th of June, but still four teams hanging around trying to get to that final. And first thing that I find that's pretty interesting is that the New York Rangers are taking a similar path or trajectory, see if it ends up that way, as they did in the 1994 Eastern Conference Championship against the New Jersey Devils. Lost the first, won the next two, lost the next two. And from my seat, game sevens speak for themselves, but I have always loved the test of character that a higher seed has to show when they have to go on the road to win a sixth game in order to save their season. And that's what the Rangers are up against the Florida Panthers, who have really owned the boards. They've owned the physical play. The Rangers had a little bit of a pushback in game five, but it wasn't enough. So for New York, this is the ultimate test of their character in order to salvage their season. But then, you go over to the Western side and Dallas has perplexed me, particularly in the first four games where they got off to a really sluggish start, really for the entirety of game one, even though that game went into a second overtime, they lost. And then it took them 40 minutes to get going in game two, and they salvaged that game. A little bit better in game three, where things kicked in for them after only 20 minutes of play. But then they have this fast start in game four, get off to the 2-0 lead, and then Edmonton just blows past them. So it seems like the better the start, the worse it ends up for them. I mean, it's hard to figure them out. Give credit to Chris Knobloch. He made some changes. He brought Corey Perry back into the lineup. He put him with Leon Draisaitl and Ryan McLeod, and he stuck with Stu Skinner after two early goals, and Skinner wound up saving their bacon with a potential save that would have made the game 3-0. So nothing would surprise me at this point. And any of the four possible combinations for the Stanley Cup final still in play.
Well, you're right about that. And the one team that I can't get my arms around is the Dallas Stars. I mean, I can describe to you the New York Rangers very well. I can describe to you the Florida Panthers very well. I can describe to you the Edmonton Oilers very well. I can't get my arms around Dallas. Now, we got Rick Bowness coming on later, who used to coach Dallas. Maybe he can figure this thing out for us. He just finished coaching Winnipeg, but before that, he was the head coach of Dallas. You're right. You just don't know what to expect out of them. Now, having said that, they never get blown out. They're always in the games, but you can't decide by the way they start whether they're going to win or lose, because you don't know what they're, how they're going to show up the next period or the period after that. And they've got some players that have come. This Wyatt Johnston kid is amazing at 20 years old. You've got Robertson, who got a hat trick the other night, who is a great scorer, but was silent for a lot of time. And then you got, a new life pumped into Tyler Seguin. I mean, he has been tremendous for them. So Dallas is an interesting thing. They've got one thing that could really hurt them. And Tanev is in a walking boot after blocking a shot the other night. If he's out of the lineup, how does that impact the Edmonton Oilers offense? Does that make them, the Dallas Stars, more vulnerable to a absolutely outstanding offensive team in the Edmonton Oilers?
Yep. And that one is going six at least. So, interesting story still waiting to be written in the Western Conference.
It's my pleasure to welcome into NHL Wraparound old friend and certainly somebody who has a distinguished coaching career in the National Hockey League, probably more distinguished than almost anybody else that's ever been in the league. But Rick Bonus, welcome, Rick. Thanks for doing this. We really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. And we've known each other a long time. It's good to see you again. Wow.
Yeah. Well, Rick, you decided to retire this year at the end of this, at the playoffs, after you guys had in Winnipeg, had a great season. Probably not the playoff that you wanted to have, but you were playing against a great opponent. And how are you feeling now in the aftermath of, for the first time, thinking, well, I won't be at training camp this year for the first time in 40 years.
I know. Well, actually, I'll take you back 2 years. Before I accepted the job in Winnipeg, Judy and I were sitting at our house back in Halifax, Nova Scotia. It was a Saturday night, and we're thinking, you know what? It's been a great run. It's probably time, right? So the next morning, the phone rang. It was Winnipeg. So they talked me out of retirement at that point. And so I knew going into Winnipeg, it wasn't going to be a 4 or 5 year term. They had some issues there that needed to be straightened out. And I think that's why they were bringing me in. We had to straighten out the culture. We had to straighten out that room. We had to straighten out the how they were playing and everything else. So I almost retired 2 years ago. But at the end of this year, as you know, Judy and I had some health issues over the winter. So it kind of changes your outlook on life a little bit and get your priority straightened out a little bit. But at the end of the year, I wasn't happy with the job I had done in the playoffs. Wasn't happy with the way the team had played. So it kind of hits you then. And somebody, an old coach a long time ago had said, you'll know when it's time. So after the end of that series, I knew it was time to retire. So basically, I've retired from coaching, haven't retired from life. So, if there's another opportunity in hockey, whether it's in the media with TV or whatever it is, as a consultant or an advisor with the team, I'd be open to anything like that. But it was time to retire from the coaching. It's a tough grind. And I didn't have a whole lot of energy left in me at the end of the season.
Rick, you're turning the reins over to Scott Arneil, who's your assistant. And he obviously took over for you when you took your leave. And Arneil has had head coaching experience before with Columbus, and he's also had stints in Washington and New York. So you're still leaving a pretty good team in his hands. What's it going to take for him to get the Jets to the next level and advance deep into the playoffs in the future?
Well, I think Scott is the perfect guy to take over because he's been there from day one. When I went in there, the first thing I told management ownership, I want Scotty Arneil to come in as the associate coach and help me out here. There was a lot of work to be done there. So Scott is the perfect guy to take over right now because he's been there through the changes of the culture, the style of play, the personnel changes. He's got a better feel for that team right now than anyone. So he's the perfect guy and he's more than ready. He's learned from that time in Columbus. And listen, coaches get fired. The first thing they do is they look at themselves. Okay, I've got to do better than this or be better than this the next time I get an opportunity. Scott has waited a long time for this opportunity and he is better prepared. So what he knows is that he knows our strengths how we have to play. He also knows what the tweaks that needed to be made so that they will have a deeper run in the playoffs. And it's not just, it's, you know, some of it's going to come from changes in the personnel. You never go back with the same team you had the year before. Some of that will happen, but he'll also know the right buttons to push on some of these guys, because 2 years or the first year we were there, we lost out. Players weren't really accepting responsibility for what happened. And my little tirade at the end of the year at that was meant to do that, to bring attention to that. This year, at the end of the year, the players were accepting a lot more responsibility. Every one of them said, I need to be better. I need to be 5 to 10% better in the playoffs. So Scott has that to work off. But the players have to accept responsibility. It happened this year. That's a positive. That's a growth for the team. And Scotty was there through the whole thing. So the tweaks to make them better in the playoffs, it starts with the players. It does. And now that Scott has a good feel of, okay, this is what we need to get better from each player so that they will have a deeper run in the playoffs.
And this is typically such a copycat league. And you look at the four clubs that are remaining in the conference finals, Florida and New York Rangers in the East, and the Oilers and Stars in the West. Based on that, where would you see the Jets needing to improve the most to get up into that elite level?
The intensity of the playoffs. It's one thing for a coach to tell the players leading into it, listen, it goes up a whole other level, two levels in the playoffs in terms of intensity, in terms of preparation, in terms of battles, in terms of everything. The players have to live that. Like I said, 2 years ago, they didn't accept a lot of responsibility. This year, they did. Now they understand, okay, when we get to the playoffs, we've got to crank up the intensity. We've got to crank up the speed. We've got to crank up the preparation. We've got to be far more diligent with the details of the game. So it all starts with that. So you look at those four teams. Yeah, they're excellent hockey teams. They are, every one of them. But they've all worked very hard. They've all played the intensity, and they've played playoff hockey from the start of the playoffs. And that's why these four teams are remaining. Colorado knocked us out. Man, that's the best anyone has played against us in the 2 years that I was there. They had won the cup 2 years ago, as you know. They played at Stanley Cup championship intensity. They did. They came at us hard. It was an eye-opener. Like, we won game one. We were lucky to win game one. The other games, we kind of self-inflicted some issues that because of their intensity and the way they were playing, we didn't handle it very well. But these four teams, man, they've played great playoff hockey from day one. And I'm still watching every game every night. Still love watching that. But if you just watch, if you're watching the games closely, you're seeing that the battles are there, the physicality is there. There's not a lot of mistakes being made. And when one team has a bad period, they identify it and they come right back with a much better period the next period. So the switches and momentum are there because the players are seeing what's going on and they're doing something about it the next period. So those four teams, man, they're all good teams. Any one of them can win the Stanley Cup. I still lean towards Dallas. So if you look at Dallas, I was there 2 years ago when we left. There's games they have as many as 10 new skaters in that lineup from 2 years ago. So they identified the weaknesses that they had in their lineup to stop them from taking a deep playoff run and then corrected it. And they have great depth, great defense now. Getting Tanner was a huge plus for them. The kid in the net, Jake Ottinger, is an outstanding goalie. So I kind of lean towards Dallas because of that, the depth. And I know the remaining eight guys in the lineup. But there's four excellent hockey teams in there. And again, any one of them can win the Stanley Cup. When it's 3-2, it's 2-2 in Dallas. Any one of them can win the Stanley Cup. They're that good of teams.
Rick, I want to talk to you about Winnipeg 1.0 and Winnipeg 2.0 in a minute, because Vic and I are both into history. But before I go there, we had Kevin Cheveldayoff off on the show a number of months ago. He was terrific, a terrific guy. He spoke so highly of you and the way that you were handling the team at that point, obviously. But he said something that made my ears perk up and that I thought listeners would like to delve into more. And that is that Scheifele and Hellebuck signed those long-term deals in the offseason. And he said, and made a real commitment to want to bring a championship to the city of Winnipeg. And that there was a lot of buy-in by your players to want to bring a championship to Winnipeg and want to see this whole thing through. And why my ears perked up on that was, well, if you hear about that in Toronto, or you hear about it in New York, or you hear about that in a major city, it doesn't surprise you. But when you hear about people wanting to stay the course in Winnipeg, you sort of go, I don't do this, but fans might say, oh, I thought the players would want to get out of there. Because it's Winnipeg and it's freezing cold and it's a small town in Canada. Tell us about what it's really like to be with the Winnipeg Jets. And it's not this outpost that a lot of people think of.
Well, it's not. Listen, Winnipeg gets the same weather as Edmonton, Calgary, Minnesota. It's not just Winnipeg that gets cold winters. It does. But if you go back to 2 years ago, before when we went in there, you just remember some of the players complaining. The culture is bad. No one wants to be there. All those things you've mentioned. I think a big part of last year, last summer was when Chevy made that trade for Dubois, and he brought in three guys that could help our hockey club, plus a draft pick. I think that showed guys like Mark and Bucky that, okay, this team is committed to winning. And the players that play in Winnipeg, listen, you mentioned 1.0. When I was there I worked for the Jets for 9 years. There was never a player that didn't want to play in Winnipeg. In that whole era, there wasn't any. It's a smaller city, but the city and the province revolves around the mood of how well the hockey team is doing. It's got a tremendous following. It does, and the players appreciate the respect and the that they get in the community and the passion that their father for the fans have, but also the ownership there, Mark Chipman, they do a phenomenal job with these players. They are treated so well in Winnipeg that you overlook some of those things that you mentioned, the weather and the small community and everything else. You overlook that because they are treated so well. Been on a lot of teams in the National Hockey League. Winnipeg treats their players as good, if not a little bit better than any franchise I've been around. They're treated with so much class and so much respect. They make the city and the franchise a fun place to play. Now, that being said, the players have to believe they have a chance to win. Mark and Bucky signed because they believe that team has a chance to win. It was a great trade Chevy made last summer. It showed that they weren't going to do a rebuild, that they're committed to winning. And I think that played a big part in those players signing on as well. And the players really enjoy playing there now. They do. I've talked to the unrestricted free agents, and they all want to re-sign there. It's not like 2 years ago, well, we can't wait to get out of here. I don't want to come back. I want to go somewhere else. It's not like that there at all. The culture in the room has changed 100%. The players enjoy being there. It's a family. They all get along great now. There's open communication in the locker room. Before, it was kind of a tight who was speaking and who wasn't. Now they all have a voice. They all feel part of what's going on there, but they really enjoy playing in Winnipeg, and they know that franchise, the organization, is committed to winning. So I think that goes back to Mark and Bucky signing those long-term deals. They're happy there. They enjoy playing there. They're treated well, and they know they have a chance to win.
Rick, do you have a concern about the long-term viability of the franchise in Winnipeg? 1.0 winds up in Arizona, and now, of course, they're going to be in Utah. But, late in the season, the commissioner made a trip up to Winnipeg to kind of sit down with ownership, with the ticket holders. And, the last thing I think anybody wants to see is this franchise have to leave Winnipeg for a second time.
I don't see that happening simply because of the commitment from the ownership. Mr. Thompson's part owner there. So there's lots of money behind the team. That's not an issue. And I think the fans, yeah, it was great when they first came back. Everyone's excited. Then, obviously that novelty wears off a little bit. But let's see them, we want to make a chance to win. The fans now see, like, we were fourth in the league. If we had any kind of specialty teams this year, we could have won the President's Trophy. That being said, everyone, players, organization, fans, all disappointed in how we did in the playoffs. But I do believe there's a strong enough fan base there and a passionate enough fan base there that'll keep that franchise there. Now, the salary cap keeps going up. right? They're going to have to stay with it, and that cap keeps going up $4 or $5 million a year. Then it's going to be up to the team to just keep spending the money to give the fans and the players a belief that they're going to win. But there's other teams in this league. They have their own cap. They don't spend to the league cap, but they have their own cap. Not every team spends to the league cap. They don't. Neil, you would know that better than me. But so they all have their own cap. But Winnipeg is willing to spend the money to make sure that they have a competitive team on the ice, and that's what the fans want to see.
Rick, so I'm really interested in this question. You may know the answer to this. I would have loved to have found it out before you came on. But are you the only hockey person remaining with the new Jets that was with the old Jets?
Craig Heisinger was there as a trainer. He's an equipment manager. And when the team left and they went into the Manitoba Moose of the American League, Zinger went into management with Randy Carlyle. And now Zinger is now the assistant general manager for the Jets. So he is the only one. And of course, Scotty O'Neill played for, I played with Scotty in Winnipeg in the early 80s. And now he's back as well. So those two guys would be, okay. That's it.
That's a really an interesting thing. And the question I really had about that, and I don't want to take all your time on this nostalgia, but could you give us any comparison of life with that mammoth sized mural of the Queen in the old Winnipeg Arena?
I was going to ask who had that mural.
Compared to today's beautiful building and everything. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean, could you compare what it was like with 1.0, meaning the team that came in from the WHA, and 2.0, meaning the team that you just finished coaching?
As long as you don't have to explain to people what the WHA is, we're okay. But people don't remember that. No, listen, the atmosphere in the old arena, as you know, it was fantastic. It was. And it goes back to that passionate fan base. And it's the same atmosphere in the new arena. The fans are so loud. You get into those whiteout games, man, there's nothing like it. And that was the same in the arena. When I was there, the first whiteout, when we had it, there was just tremendous, tremendous atmosphere, tremendous noise in that whole rink. And it's carried over into the new arena. So it is the same. We missed the portrait of the Queen. We do. It probably took up about 100 seats. But anyways, it's the same atmosphere now in the arena. And that goes back to giving the fans a lot of credit, that passionate fan base that they have there that's going to carry that franchise. But it's a fantastic atmosphere. And the players who come in and they haven't played in front of the whiteout before, like, it's shocking to them. They were nervous that first game back this year. We had four or five guys there that hadn't played in that. They were a little nervous. They were a little taken aback by the noise and the enthusiasm of the crowd. So it is the same, without a doubt.
Rick, a quick one to add on to that. When the whiteout started, I remember them starting that in Winnipeg in the old arena and that. And I thought it was a whiteout. It was a play on the snow that is in Winnipeg, and a play on the fact that the white uniforms that the Jets wore at home. So we were all going to come in the same white that our home team had on. And then the league switched to having dark at home. Did it ever confuse everybody? What are we going to do with the whiteout now? It's the visitors that are in white and we're in dark.
You give Michael Hearn credit for that. Good guys wear white. That was the whole theme behind that thing. Good guys wear white. And that came from Michael Hurd. So, yeah. So that didn't change anything. So it's good guys wear white. And, yeah, regardless of the color of the ice, the home uniform, the home ice is wearing, good guys wear white was the premise behind that whole
thing. Rick, you spent almost four decades behind an NHL bench as a head coach, associate, assistant. What is the biggest piece of evolution that you have seen in 40 years in coaching? Is it technology? Is it technique? Can you share that with our listeners?
It's a little bit of everything, but from a coaching perspective, it's communication now that has changed drastically in our game, the coaches and the players. And Neil, you'll go back to 92 when I lost my job in Boston. They didn't like the fact that I had relationships with the players and was talking to the players all the time as much much as I did. That was a different era. This era today, these players, they need to know what you're thinking. They need to know that you have their best interests at heart. And that all comes from your ability to create a one-on-one relationship and trust with each and every player. So the communication is huge. The game has changed drastically. The game is so much faster. There's so much detail into coaching now than we did in before in the 80s and the 90s. Every face-off is important. The game, the league is so tight that every detail matters. Every face-off matters. Win or lose, in any face-off, you've got to have a plan and you've got to stay on top of those details. The details are magnified. The relationship coaches have with players totally changed. The game is so much better now than it was. And it's so much faster now. Their players are so much skilled. But those players want to know why. Those questions were never asked before. You were doing this. Okay. Now why are we doing that? And the coach has to have that answer for them. This is why. This is okay. We're doing this. But then it's what's our next play? So you got to have the answer for that as well. It's not simply, okay, we're going to do this, get it out. We're going to get it out. What are we going to do now? And the players want to know why. So it goes, the tactics have changed. The details have changed. Most important change has been the ability of the coach to communicate those things with their players. And you have to have that one-on-one with your players. And they've got to know you have their best interest in heart. They've got to learn to trust you. And it starts with that.
Rick, it's interesting what Vic just asked you and to take you back there. And of course, I go back where you were, but from a different perspective. But tell me your perspective now on video replay, for example, on offside. We all know that goal, no goal is something, but you've gone through this where, you know, when you started, you had one referee, two linesmen. There was no cameras in the building at all. There wasn't even cell phones. And now you've gotten to the point where every time a goal goes in and the TV camera goes on the bench, the coaches all have their head down looking at the floor, looking to see if there's one thing that could maybe went wrong so that they can call it back. Was there goaltender interference? Was it offside? The video guy upstairs, come on, give us something. What's that like? I mean, you've gone from, as I said, no cell phones to this.
Yeah, well, again, adapt or die, man. You got to keep moving forward. But now we have two video coaches, and that's their job. They have different camera angles. We're in constant communication with them. They have to tell us right away. We're not making that call by what we see. We're relying on our video coaches in the video room to look at it, and they're getting three different camera angles, and we're just stalling. We're looking down. We're trying to buy time until they tell us what they're doing. And I tell our video coach, I'll live and die with what you tell me to do. If it's wrong, it's wrong. But we got to make a decision here whether we're challenging it or not challenging it. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. You can't be afraid to make the wrong call. And the offsides are usually that's the easy one. That goalie interference, man, oh man, it's a gray area for everybody, and you never know what you're going to get. And that's just because of the pace of the game. It goes back, the game is so fast today. You need the two refs and you need that video replay. You wish some of those video replays would take a lot in shorter time and get to the point like right away. Some of them are dragged out and it just loses momentum for everybody, players, fans, everybody. But that's the game we are today. And again, we rely on video coaches more than ever before. That's the biggest difference. But again, they've got different angles and different cameras they're looking at, and they've got like 20 seconds to make that call, right? And they're for unsure, then we're stalling. We're going to give a hand up and wait a minute. And the refs have been great. They give you that extra 10, 15, 20 seconds before you can make the call. But that's a tough call. But again, you got to have faith in your video coaches, and they can't be afraid to make the wrong call. We'll live and die with what you say.
You know what, Rick, you, me, and Vic are all the same vintage. We really are. We come from the same era. I could talk to you all day long because we got so many things in common. I want to give you one last question for fun. Tell me that today's rule that you hate the most.
Oh, that's, you know, it's the, I don't like the goalie trapezoid. Like, remember the goalies used to get caught out in the corner, right? Yeah. And the whole race is getting excited. The players are going, there's a goalie stuck in the corner, right? Now they can't go in there. It leads to more contact. The D are taking a pounding because of that, because the goalie can't go get it. But when those goalies, remember Marty Brodeur, he'd be in the corner and he'd be battling for guys with the puck and everything. So that's wide open. Kind of missed out a little bit. To get rid of that. Again, I think the D are taking more of a pounding because of those things. The goalie out of the net, it's pretty exciting. I'm sure there's more than ever. That's the first thing that pops to my head. I've never been a big fan of that. But I always hated those premeditated fights. I'm glad they're out of our game. You know, there's tapping on the shin pads and they warm up. We got to fight so we keep our jobs. I hated that. That had absolutely nothing to do with the flow of the game. So I'm glad that's gone. There's little details. You're always trying to make the game better. But those are the kind of things that, I watch for closely.
And Vic, just to let you know this, because I already told Rick this when we talked on the phone, I watched him fight one of our Adirondack players, and he put a whooping on the guy too that night, because I remember a scout coming over to me and saying, "You can't let that guy fight Bonus. Are you crazy?" So
I also think the other guy couldn't fight, so yeah.
Well, Rick, this has really been fun. I hope we can do it again sometime. We wish you and your wife all the best going forward, and health-wise, especially more than anything else. Just look after yourself. And you've been such a great NHL person all these years. And, you've done so much for the game, and you really have. So thank you for that. And thank you for coming on here.
Thanks, Rick.
Well, I enjoyed it. Good to see you. Nice talking to you guys again. Like, I've retired from coaching. I haven't retired from life. And I'd like to stay in the game in some capacity somewhere. So I'm not going anywhere. I'm just retiring from coaching. But it's great talking to you guys. Great to see you again, Neil. It's been a while. It's been too long. So I can get back on your show and help you out. Let me know. We got time now.
We can talk. Yeah, that's right. And we can, as I said, and I know Vic is the same way because he's more long-winded than me. We could go on for hours about all this stuff because we love talking nostalgia and past and present and everything. And that's what this show is all about. So you fit right in. Maybe you can come in as a co-host at some point.
Sounds good. You got to take care of yourself.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Time now for a quick shout out to our sponsor. NHL Wraparound is brought to you by MyGray, your source for game worn jerseys. Head to MyGray.com to get your collection started today. Get real, get it from MyGray. NHL Wraparound subscribers can take 10% off any hockey jersey when they order at MyGray.com and use the coupon code WRAP10. Don't forget that coupon code, WRAP10.
Welcome back to NHL Wraparound. Vic and Neil along with you. And just a little promotional note that we have launched first episode of 1990 Forever, the 30th anniversary commemoration of the New York Rangers 1994 Stanley Cup Championship. The road begins with Glenn Healy and John Davidson. That episode is already live. On June 5th, we will drop the quick path to the Eastern Final with Steve Ballmer and Kevin Lowe. June 10th, a series for the ages with Mike Richter and Stéphane Matteau. And then on June 14th at 10:59 p.m., the exact minute the Rangers clinched the Stanley Cup, the episode, This One Will Last a Lifetime, and Neil and I will be joined with Captain Mark Messier, Brian Leetch, and Adam Graves. And then on June 17th, our final show will be Reflection, where team members, the media, and fans can share what that single championship has meant to them. So, and also we've got an exclusive kickoff party that Neil and I will be hosting, and you can register for that on nhlwraparound@gmail.com. So, Neil, really looking forward to those things. And, we've spent a lot of time with some great players with that club. And this was really just a thrilling series to add to our catalog of shows.
Well, it was a project that came from your your own thought process, and you told me about it many months ago, and it's been a fun project. It's been tremendous to have the participants come in and do it. I've really had fun. It's been nostalgic. It's been emotional. It's been cathartic. There's a lot of terms for that. It brings you back 30 years like it was yesterday, yes, yesterday when you talk about these things. And so I give you the credit for being the brain. It's your brainchild, but it's been, I think that the viewers and listeners will really enjoy going back in time and remembering where they were, if they were alive, and what it felt like to them.
And the stories that we have been privileged enough to hear have been nothing short of remarkable. So hopefully everybody will tune in for each of the 5 episodes and enjoy them as much as we have enjoyed recording them. And switching gears here now, Neil, we had our buddy Don Waddell on a couple of months ago, who at the time was the general manager of the Carolina Hurricanes. And now, so to speak, he will be steering Columbus's ship.
Yes, he has gone to the Blue Jackets and left the Hurricanes. At the time that we had him on, he was such a great guest because the Gensel trade at the deadline, or close to the deadline, was the biggest trade in the league this season. And he got into all the nuances of that trade. And also we got to talk to him about Ron, about his coach, Rod Brind'Amour, and whether or not he was going to re-sign, and about all the players that he had ahead of him to sign in the offseason. But mostly at that particular time, place and time, we're talking about the potential of his team winning the Stanley Cup, or how far could they go in the playoffs. So it was a great episode, but now suddenly he's off to Ohio.
What do you think for him the biggest challenges? I mean, he's obviously had a club that had knocked on the door for several years, and now, in effect, you go to a bottom feeder. So what are the benefits for him switching jobs to really a team that has probably a relatively high upside, but you're also starting all over again?
Well, you know, we just talked to Rick Bowness about his time in Winnipeg. And when he went to Winnipeg, he had to change the culture. He had to change some issues that they had there. He had to get a lot of things turned around so that they could have the kind of season they had this past year. And the players taking responsibility and so on and so forth. Now, from the GM point of view, he's got a lot of work to do, meaning Don Waddell in Columbus, because he's got to have to change that culture. This is not a put down to the people that were there before, but obviously the culture's not right, or they wouldn't be where they are in the standings this year and be a team that was hoping to get the first overall pick in the lottery. That's how far down the food chain they were this season. And there's got to be something wrong in the water there for them to continue like this. So Don's going to have to do what he did in Carolina and help what he did do in Carolina, along with Ron Francis, along with Rod Brind'Amour and others. He's going to have to bring those kind of changes to Columbus, which is going to be a lot of work internally before the stuff that we see on the outside, like re-signing players, signing free agents, hiring a coach, or whatever.
What's the single biggest attribute that he brings to this organization? You know him a long time, and how is he going to make the biggest difference there?
You know, he's got a ton of experience. He's been working in the NHL for many, many years. I worked with him in 1989-90 when he was running the Flint Spirits of the IHL. And after that, he moved on to get into the NHL. He was assistant GM with Ken Holland in Detroit. After that, he got hired as the only GM. Well, he wasn't the only one. Rick Dudley took over for the last year of the Atlanta Thrashers, but he was mainly the only GM of the Atlanta Thrashers. When he finished with Atlanta, he did not go to Winnipeg with the team when they moved, but he did go to Carolina, where he joined Peter Karmanis, who was the majority owner at the time, a Detroit native. Don Waddell was a Detroit native. They knew each other. He went there as a president and the business guy. When Ron Francis decided to leave, he became the GM. We can go on and on and on. There's been a long, long career. I think what he brings there is a wealth of experience. He's whatever happens, he's already seen it once before. So he's seen every movie, and he'll be able to identify what you have to change to become a winning organization.
I don't want to leave the team that he left behind in this discussion. And whoever is taking over is really going to have their hands full. I mean, the one thing that Waddell did tell us was that the Brind'Amour deal was close to getting done when we spoke to him. And indeed, that deal has taken place. But the incoming GM has 8 unrestricted free agents: Nason, Martinuk, Gensel, Teravainen, Chatfield, D'Angelo, Pesci, and Shea. Some of them have already indicated that they do want to stay with the organization. Drury, Jarvis, Natchez, and Comtois are restricted free agents. And you look on top of this, that next season, the rest of their defense corps, Dmitry Orlov, Jacob Slavin, who is just named Lady Bing Trophy winner, by the way, and Brent Burns, are all unrestricted. So you've got an owner in Tom Dundon that's a little tight with the purse straps there. So this is really going to be quite a job for an incoming GM to be able to maintain a high-end club.
It's going to be a lot of work. And if... you know, he's going to have to strap himself to his desk from now until the training camp, because that's just a ton of work. Now, the owner there, Tom Dundon, does participate heavily in the activities of the team. It's not like as if he's off doing another business and he leaves the general manager to handle all the hockey. He participates in it quite a lot. So I'm sure he will be there also alongside and trying to make these decisions and hurrying signings along. But boy, oh boy, they got a lot of work to do. Now, Carolina is a place that players do want to play. It's not a place that they don't want to go. It's a beautiful place. Raleigh, North Carolina is a great place to live. It's got great weather. They have a beautiful building. They're treated really well. The players are so, and they've got a great coach in Rod Brind'Amour, who's a player's coach. I mean, he was a great player himself. So it is a nice place to play if they are competitive with their contracts. They probably will be able to keep most of their players. Somebody like Gensel is probably looking at a huge career payday, the last big, huge contract he could get. So you may see him go out and just go to the highest bidder.
This is the human side of the story, brought to you by the Game 7 Group. And we just heard a little while ago from our special guest, Rick Bonus, and being a bench boss for 38 years from the head coaching, associate, and assistant positions, nobody knows teamwork like Rick Bonus does. And at the Game 7 Group, transforming individuals into cohesive groups allows every team the potential to achieve extraordinary results. Game 7 Group offers various services such as team building events, plus coaching and speaking engagements aimed at improving team dynamics, productivity, and overall performance. We all want to be able to succeed in the big moment. Check out the Game 7 Group website at game7group.com/NHL wraparound to learn more. Right now, a special incentive offer awaits our podcast listeners. Take your team to the next step. The Game 7 Group will get you there. And now with a little bit more on Rick Bonus, Neil, the floor is yours.
Well, I've known Rick Bonus, as I said, since 1982, 83, when he was playing coach for the Sherbrooke team in the American Hockey League. But I just wanted to run through a little bit of a remarkable life, a remarkable career that this man has had in the National Hockey League. It's been a quiet career because, honestly, he's not somebody that goes into histrionics, and he's not John Tortorella, who's a good friend of both of ours, but he has a very distinguished career. He was born in Moncton, New Brunswick, way back in 1955. He played as a player. He was a right winger. He was drafted by the Atlanta team, not the Thrashers, but the Flames back in the 1975 amateur draft. He also played for Detroit Red Wings, St. Louis Blues, and the original Winnipeg Jets. He played there. He also served as a head coach for the original Jets. He served as head coach for the Boston Bruins, the Ottawa Senators, the New York Islanders, the Phoenix Coyotes, recently the Dallas Stars, and most recently the Winnipeg Jets. He had an associate coach position with the Vancouver Canucks and the Tampa Bay Lightning. His 2,726 games as that NHL head coach or assistant coach are the most by anyone in league history. It's amazing, really. The other part about Rick personally, NHL draft, as I said, was 1975, 26th overall to the Atlanta Flames. But he was also drafted in the WHA, the World Hockey Association, by Wayne Gretzky's team, or would be team later on in 1975, 62nd overall. He went to the Indianapolis Racers. So, yeah, then which is the team that Wayne Gretzky signed with and then was traded to the Edmonton Oilers, thereby how he became an Oiler. But Rick Bowness has had a remarkable life, a remarkable career. And, boy, it's just a pleasure to talk to him. And he's had just such a great life.
Such a great interview that we had with him, also so personable. And you could almost see kind of the relief that, you know, at the head coaching piece of his life is now behind him and he's got so much more to look forward to. And just a great guest that we had today. So, you know, my human side takes a little bit different path. And, you know, we're checking the calendar. May 31st, 1987 was the first time that a Stanley Cup final had actually extended to the last day in May. And the reason it did was a game that happened 3 days earlier on May 28th. The Oilers and the Flyers, game six at the Philadelphia Spectrum, in what is still regarded as the loudest moment the Spectrum has ever had. And I was actually there working as a statistician for ESPN on the roof of the building alongside Mike Emmerich and Bill Clement. And to give a little bit of background on that series, the Flyers were down 3-1, went to Edmonton where the parade route was already set and the Oilers were going to finish this series in game five. And the Oilers got out to a 2-0 lead. And wouldn't you know it, the Flyers come back and they win the game 3-2. So now a lot of anticipation going on for game six. Kate Smith, the video is brought out and they play it on the scoreboard in place of the national anthem singing God Bless America. Flyers are down 2-1 in the third period. And I get a call from the producer, Brian Cooper, and he says, "Hey, Vic, I want you to go down into the Oilers locker room and produce the post game if they win." And I'm like thinking, man, pretty cool. Stat guy going into the Stanley Cup winning locker room. Well, that never happened because Brian Propp tied the game on a power play goal with 6:56 left. And then just a buck 24 later, an errant clear by Jari Kurri ended up in the wheelhouse for J.J. Daigneau, who stepped into one from the blue line and blew it past Grant Fuhr to put the Flyers ahead. And, Neil, you've been in enough buildings where there is the usual cheer of the crowd, and then there's this pitch that goes up about 3 or 4 octaves when there's absolute delirium going on. And that's what it was like. And Clement took his headset off, turned to me, and just shook his head. Because that press box upstairs was actually shaking from the roof of the Spectrum. That's how loud it was. But a lot of people don't remember the end of that game because with 10 seconds left, Ron Hextall went to clear a puck, threw it up the ice. Marc Messier reached up, took it out of the air, put it on his stick, and skated in alone on Hextall, who had to make 2 saves before the final buzzer went off. So it was just an amazing finish. And just to top this off, Phil Collins was playing across the street that night at the Vet. And he said, you know what, before the game, I'm going to be out. My concert will be over by 10 o'clock. Well, yeah, he was about an hour off. And that was the same time that the hockey game let out. So there were about 100,000 delirious people in the parking lots at that sports complex. And it was about 2 hours before I could even bother moving my car to get back to the hotel. So just an amazing night that I will never forget that took place 37 years ago.
I remember that Stanley Cup very well, but I don't remember it that well as you do, having been there. All I know is I wonder who I was even hoping for back then. I was with the Red Wings, and so I don't know. We probably assumed that the Oilers would win because they were so strong back then. But that's a great story.
They did win in the seventh game.
Yeah, and I've been in the Spectrum when it was going bonkers, but not quite that bonkers. But anyway, I want to thank My Gray and Game 7 Group for their sponsorship of NHL Wraparound. Thanks to all of the listeners. And remember, the first episode in our 1990 Forever series commemorating the New York Rangers 1994 Stanley Cup Championship is live right now. And Glenn Healy and John Davidson are very entertaining, talking the regular season and a whole lot more, a lot of great stories, a lot of good laughs, a lot of nostalgia. So I'm sure you'll enjoy that. But for today, thank you. Don't forget to join us again next week for the next episode of NHL Wraparound.
Thanks for joining us on the NHL Wraparound Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to stay up to date on all the NHL action.